Hello, everybody. Welcome. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Terry. Hey, Di. Jeff Salzman, Terry Patton, and Diane Hamilton, hosting really people from all over the world who are here tonight to talk about the events that happened on Monday in Boston with the bombing at the Boston Marathon. Terry and Di and I go way back. We've been working together, tilling the fields in the integral world for, gosh, close to 10 years now, doing the Integral Institute seminars and the Integral Spiritual Experiences and the What Next conference last New Year's. And we continue to work together. We were working on a project that's coming up this fall called the Integral Living Room in Boulder that we're going to be doing starting actually on Halloween night. And we just couldn't get to the topic. We were all worked up over this bombing and talking about it. And it occurred to us that it would be fun to share the conversation that we were having and include more people in this conversation. So we decided to, in the spur of the moment, put this call together, and we did, and here we are. It's Thursday night, April 18th, and I'm happy to be here doing this. One of the things that we realize in the integral world space is that we're grateful, really, to Ken and, you know, various integral thinkers for this model that helps us to see and hold and metabolize many perspectives on any issue. And that integrals, like, I often think of it as the Google map. It just, so you can sort of move the dial a little bit and just see a deeper resolution into things. You just see more texture. You just feel into things and feel into perspectives. And it's just uniquely delicious to be able to have conversations with other people who have this worldview. So as we were putting together and some of the work we're doing, there's a Rumi quote that we uncovered that I think just hits the nail on the head. And he says, "There are three ways to approach the mystery of the divine. There are three ways to approach the mystery of the divine. The first practice is prayer. The second is meditation. And the third, and most important, is conversation." And I love that. And so here we are. The idea is, let's have a conversation. Let's see how bringing a we space to this and actually interacting with each other and feeling into each other can really help us understand and feel in to this situation, which is really just in many ways a proxy for our lives and just this unpredictable and tragic nature of life on planet Earth as human beings. So that's sort of what we're doing here tonight. And so I just say hello to my colleague, Terry Patton. Hi, Terry. Anything you want to say for a hello?
Well, I just want to welcome everybody who's joined us and to say that the conversation that we can have here, even though there are a lot of us on the line, is a more intimate and shared one and where our interiors can come forward. And it's that that's so missing from the public conversation in the media. There's just, you know, a kind of blank wall of shock and anger and what are we going to do about it that doesn't go very deep into the interiors. So I just want to welcome everybody into a space that's more intimate, more reflective, and more profound. And I love sharing that with you too. So let's go.
All right. Welcome, everybody. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to share in this conversation. And I agree with Jeff and Terry. I think that when I'm with my colleagues and friends in the integral world, that there's a kind of conversation that can happen because there's just a lot of guideposts that we tend to share and understand. And so we navigate the conversation with a certain kind of ease. And at the same time, we know that there are many, many coexisting perspectives, and it's easy to sometimes hold contradictory perspectives in relationship to each other and agree to inhabit the inexplicable part of things. So I thought in the way of just beginning and launching that it might be nice to bring in Sri Aurobindo just to hear his comment basically related to good and evil, because evil is one of the first questions that come up, that question about why would someone do this. So I wanted to share this with you just as a starting point. So Sri Aurobindo says, that in the cosmic dispensation, evil comes out of good and good out of evil, and there seems to be no exact correspondence between the moral and the vital measures. All we can really say is that good done tends to increase the sum and total power of good in the world, and the greater it grows, the greater the likely to be the sum of human happiness. And that evil done tends to increase the sum and total power of evil in the world, and the greater it grows, and then greater is the likely to be the sum of human suffering. And eventually man or nation doing evil in some way has to pay for it, but not in any kind of way that we can measure. And not always in, you know, translating in terms of good or ill fortune. So Aurobindo says, you know, we observe that good and evil are related and that there is evil in the world. And we also see that practicing good creates good and that we're happier with goodness and vice versa. So I just thought that would be nice as a departure point to kind of, you know, almost give like a big perspective on this topic, which we'll return to at the end of our call. Now we're going to actually drill down, and we're going to use the structure of I, we, and it to navigate for this conversation. So the first part of our call, we're going to be concerned with I and what each of our personal responses to this, and we're really going to ground ourselves in the, you might say, the sovereignty and the authority of our own I experience. Then we're going to move to the we. We're going to look at who is the we here. What are the different we's that are coexisting, and what do we do, think, feel together about this, and who do we include in that? What level of consciousness? Is the we ethnocentric? Is it world-centric? Is it both? Is it so? What are the considerations from the we? And I know that we have a representative from the Boston Integral Group, and we definitely will reach out to you to speak on behalf of the We of Boston. It would be very good to hear from you on that. And we have people who are within the U.S. and also people outside of the U.S., and we want to make sure that we have a world-centric perspective, including those who identify within the sort of national identity and those beyond it. And the Boston Marathon is a great world-centric event. People from all over the globe participate. So we'll spend time in the we, and then we're going to move to the it and talk about the world and how is it affected and how do we feel about surveillance and protection versus freedom and what do we mean by this spirit to overcome? What is that? And, you know, what can the it offer to the conversation? And then we're going to leave plenty of time for more discussion to get some of your perspectives on the last half hour of the call. And in each, the I, the we, and the it, will take some time for you to pop into small groups and have some small group discussion, and then we'll come back into the large group. So we'll open this up by just basically, I want to invite Terry and Jeff to take just a minute or two to talk about how were you personally affected by this event? What came up for you? How have you related to it? I'm just curious.
Well, I'll take a stab at that. It's Jeff here. I was, of course, touched and horrified, as we all were, I think. I think that's a natural human response to this, especially thinking about that little 10-year-old boy. And of course, the other two, both young people, you know, with their lives ahead of him. But this one picture of this 10-year-old boy holding up a sign that he had made, it's been, you know, in the media a lot, of holding up a sign about some version of why can't people be nicer to each other? And he's missing his front tooth and his big eyes. And he's gone, you know, in this most, you know, horrific and apparently senseless way. I mean, who knows? This, you know, whether there's some method to the madness or some point. This. I think evolutionary theory or developmental theory helps us to understand this. I mean, is this a jihadi where it's coming from a traditional where it's this good versus evil and America is seen as the evil? And, you know, is it coming from that? Or is it coming from a place of, you know, kind of the Joker in Batman where I just want to see the world burn? You know, there are people for whom it's just entertaining to cause mayhem. And there's no, I always think of that iconic scene in Batman with Heath Ledger as the Joker with his smeared makeup and lipstick, and they're asking him as they have him in custody, what's he trying to do? And he looks at them for a long moment and says, do I look like a man with a plan?
Oh, wow.
And it's just, you know, I mean, we don't know yet what the motivation was here. And it's the human condition that we are violent towards each other. That's not gone yet by any means. And yet, and this is another thing that an evolutionary view brings for us, and that is that century by century, the human condition has gotten more and more peaceful, less and less violent. And that is, even including the first half of the 20th century with the two world wars, per capita violence is down and dropping. There's always this sort of conditioned response of, because we are in a world where, and this is a spiritual principle, where death is on our shoulder. I mean, we're ultimately, in a certain ultimate sense, ants on the sidewalk. We could go at any minute as we're driving down the street, or we run into the madman with a gun or a bomb. I mean, we are finite creatures. And that's just, you know, that's hard to wrap your head around. And this, an incident like this sort of pushes it in your face, that this could happen to anybody at any time. And yet, we have to look at the larger trajectory, or else we just extrapolate from that, that we're living in some uniquely degraded time, which is continually to be degraded, and it's getting worse, and what a world, and how awful it is. And I think an integral view has to challenge that. Even with this kind of a situation, to look and see that, yes, the whole country is riveted on this incident that happened on Monday. It's, you know, wall-to-wall news. Three people died, 100 people injured, or 100-plus people injured, and yet the whole country is riveted on this because it represents that wild card. I always think of the line from this play that I saw called When You Coming Back, Red Rider. And I always, this line hit me between the eyes, and the lead character says, "The only thing we ultimately have to fear is a madman with a gun." It's just that wild card thing. You know, Terry, I think I just turn it to you and see what your initial impressions are.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, I think that what came up for me was, first of all, a feeling of a wound, because we have been pretty much free of terrorist attacks that have been, you know, bombing attacks, I guess, of this particular nature for so long. And it had seemed that we were emerging from the kind of paranoid bunker Fortress America mentality. And it felt to me, particularly because there were those, it didn't take very long for the reports about the ricin-laced letters to hit the news. And that was, for me, an echo of the anthrax letters right after 9/11. And the potential for us to descend into paranoia and the puncturing of the safety of our public spaces. This is a really celebratory, as you said, a world-centric event. It's a place where people come together. From the reports from the day, it was just a beautiful day. People were really being very sweet to each other in these public places, and it was a day of celebration. And the destructiveness of that is just a wound. And I think I just let myself take the hit and just let my heart be pierced by all of that and the potential for it to stimulate reactions in our culture and society that are perhaps even worse than the event itself. Would there be copycat bombings? Would there be an increase in the militarization and paranoid response? And what would be the ramifications of this? And of course, my heart was just going out to the actual physical victims of this particular attack. And the sense also of revulsion at the media attention bringing my attention to a level that felt superficial and didn't meet me in the depths of my being. And it's such a shame that we get shocked in this way, and yet we aren't able to have a public conversation that drops us into our depths. And all of those things were aspects of the wound that this event represented for me.
Wow, there's a lot in that, you guys. Yeah, I think for me, you know, that expression used of just having your heart pierced, you know, and then the training I've done over the years of working with Tonglin practice of feeling the pierce, and then also just feeling the incredible, you know, bodhicitta, the awakened mind, you know, that's also always present at the same time, you know, in terms of, you know, I immediately saw a quote of Mr. Rogers that had a lot of meaning to me at the time, which was, you know, whenever he would see something on television that was really frightening to him like this when he was a child, his mother would always say, and notice who's helping. Who's helping? So that kind of came up for me just in terms of the years of doing the exchanging of pain with, you know, compassion. So I spent quite a lot of time in that. And then my mind started to drift, and I've been watching Homeland. I don't know about the rest of you. So I haven't been under the impression that we're outside of this ethnocentric America. You know, in fact, watching Homeland and seeing Zero Dark Thirty, I realize actually we're deeply involved in a jihad, and it's ongoing. So I woke up in the morning just all over the policy of the U.S. and the Middle East, and pissed off about oil, and pissed off about what I think is a very confused relationship to Israel in my mind. And so Middle East policy was sort of where my mind went in terms of trying to fix the problem, you know, because I wasn't considering, I've been so in that, you know, Zero Dark 30 mind state that I immediately went to, you know, our involvement in jihad and the war in Afghanistan and the drone strikes and the, you know, just what we've done in Baghdad over the last, just the incredible American involvement in these wars post 9/11. So I guess my mind went along the way yours did too, in terms of the ramifications and getting deeper and deeper ensconced in something that we're not going to be able to extricate ourselves from. So those are some of the things that came up for me. And, you know, the wild card you talked about, Jeff, that, you know, human development and consciousness, and, you know, what level was this all coming from? Is it sheer madness? And having said that, I do want to acknowledge, because I think it's important from an integral perspective, that on that same day that this happened, that there was a bombing in Baghdad, and there was also one, as I understand it, in Somalia. And we're working with the Boston one, Jeff, Terry and I, because it has the most proximity, but that doesn't mean that it ultimately, the others don't have as much meaning. So go ahead and you're going to have 6 minutes. You'll have a one-minute warning. We'll come back to the main room and hear some of the other perspectives that maybe we haven't raised so far. So be thinking about things that come up, and we're going to move to the we and the it, so there's going to be plenty of time to presence everything that's in your consciousness. So we'll see you in 6 minutes from now. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. I hope that you had an enlivened conversation when you were able to talk to each other. What we'd like to do now is we'd like to actually just presence, if you're willing, we want to presence just some perspectives that came up in your experience. And we're going to ask you to do this in kind of a one-breath style. So some perspectives that arose, and if you have a perspective that you think would serve the whole group, please press 1 on your handheld. So an example might be, wow, I was so strongly identified with the mother of that child who died. Or I was so identified with the spectators that were there cheering people on, and or those first responders who went into that scene of mayhem. So any other perspective that really came up for you in your experience, press 1 on your handheld, and we'll gather up about 10 or 12 of those and then we'll move into talking about the we. Okay, and Terry will call on you. So go ahead, Terry.
Okay, this first caller, I don't know your name.
Good. Hi, Terry. This is Ellis Gold.
Oh, hi, Ellis.
Hi. Dorothy and I pretty much agreed on that this is a horrible event. We both have connections with Boston. I went to Boston University, and Dorothy grew up in that area. We see it as being just a sad event. We're really, you know, the child being very important because of what he was saying and how he expressed himself. And we agree that this goes on all over the world. And I said, I really can't stand the way the media is portraying it and the way our politicians are utilizing it. I just put in one more thing, that we had another huge accident the other day, just last night. I don't know how many people were killed. And there's no play on that whatsoever. And that is, the corporation didn't take care of business, it looks like. So that's all I have to say. I don't want to abuse the time.
Thank you, Ellis.
Yeah, you're talking about the explosion in Texas, the fertilizer plant, I think, probably.
That's correct.
Okay, thank
okay.
you.
Ed Rosenstein.
Hi, Terry. Thank you so much for letting me in. I'm from Boston, and I've met Terry, and I've met Diane at the Integral WET a number of years ago. I want to focus on the positive. I really appreciate that President Obama came to our city and that all of the dignitaries spoke, and I'm just so touched by the heroism and the outpouring of love and generosity of this city. And I want to say that I agree that in the media there's not a focus on seeing this from an integral perspective. And I would like to think that in the future that we will have the medical sophistication to be able to treat people who perpetrate these acts so that we can operate on their prefrontal cortex that is implicated in their inability to make decisions that affect people. And also I want to touch on the issue of violence in general. You know, you in Colorado have tragically experienced violence in Aurora recently, and the Congress has not passed the gun control legislation, and this is also implicated, I think, in our society. And we really need to, I think, take a wider perspective on this. But I just want to speak as a Bostonian.
Yeah.
Thank you so
yeah,
much.
Totally.
And I just want to say I'm very grateful for you convening this this call tonight. I want to acknowledge that. And thank you so
okay.
much.
Okay. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Okay. Bev Roach. There we are. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I'm just reminded of Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, Call Me By My True Name. When I think about this incident, that I could, in the right circumstance or the right consciousness, be play any of those parts, from the terrorist to the families, to the runners, to the victims, to the nations that celebrate us and then are angry with us. And I just feel compassion for the whole situation. And my prayer is that somehow we can find a way to heal the grievances of all humanity and take responsibility for our part as a nation and a people in perpetrating situations worldwide and within our own country that foment that kind of rage. That's all I got to say.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
Thank you. Wow. Cool.
Yeah, really. Okay, Lois Ross.
Hello. So I'm in Boston also, and I spent part of the afternoon cheering on the runners at Mile 17. It was just such a magnificent day, and people were happy. I was inspired. I saw a runner go by who was a double amputee. People were coming and finding, you know, they had their families who were waiting in a certain spot, and they'd come over and get a hug and a kiss, and then they'd keep on running. And it was just a magnificent day, a worldwide race, and yet something very essentially Boston about it. It's just a great day. And so when I came back a couple hours later and heard what happened, it was just a sense of how fleeting things are, that something so wonderful could turn so quickly to something so awful. And at the same time, the elements of people helping other people was certainly there. So, you know, there was still something about the beauty of what it started out as. A sense of tremendous grief, feeling that the city that I love was just violated in an awful way. And I had also a sense that this felt to me like a homegrown act of terror, and it felt, and it may or it may not be, but there was just something about it that felt like we're doing this to ourselves.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carrot Nudo. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Yes, I'm also in the Boston area, and a friend of my son's was there when the actual explosions happened. I haven't talked to him, but my son's been in contact. And, you know, I have such hugely mixed feelings, and I think all three, just about everyone who's talked has said something that I felt. And I think the key thing So I talked to my parents afterwards. They were worried I might have been there. And they had been watching the news. And I told them, you know, I haven't been watching it. Every now and then I was checking in on the internet, on CNN or, you know, some more reputable news outlet and just looking for facts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems almost like if the act, and it almost certainly was meant to frighten people, if we engross ourselves in it, and it's going to become more and more frightening, and then you're actually doing what the intention was, you know. And as Jeff pointed out at the beginning, there's been so much more goodness that has been done all around this event. You know, people going to donate blood, people running in to help, you know, people not running away from the explosions, but running to it to pull people away. And all the people that are saying now they're going to run the marathon next year to show solidarity,
yeah.
You know. And Jeff pointed out, you know, the world does really seem to be evolving towards more good and less evil. Why do we have to see the such a harsh evil in the middle of it, you know?
Well, that's one of the sort of challenges of holding multiple perspectives. Can we have a broken heart at the tragedy of this, and particularly the personal tragedy of these young people and their families and all the people who were injured, and then also see that in some ways this reminds us that, and the fact that we're riveted by this in statistically small event by, you know, any statistical point of view.
The statistics, Jeff, are that you have a 1 in 20 million chance of being killed by a terrorist attack.
Is that right?
And a 1 in 19,000 chance of being killed in a traffic accident.
Yeah, exactly. That.
Can I offer a statistic too?
Yeah.
I heard a statistic that I thought was an interesting one. So there have been 2,000 terrorist events incidents, but there have only been like a dozen that it, where there have actually been injury or death. This is the fifth most serious one since I think 1970 is what he said. But what was interesting to me is obviously there was New York 9/11 and the other planes that went down, and then there was the Oklahoma City bomb. But one that doesn't even register in my mind is the poisoning of the Bhagwan's community up in Oregon is like number 3. And this is number 5 in terms of the amount of damage that was done to the injury and death. This is the fifth most serious.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, huh? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and I just say that what you just said, Di, is from an American perspective, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that except to notice that we have an ethnocentric, there's a part of us that it's like you said earlier, the same day that this happened, there were 55 people killed in Baghdad in a bombing. There were 27 killed again today in Baghdad. There were 30 killed yesterday in Somalia. And yet, these three in our country rivet us in a way, and that's just where we're at. We need to notice as integralists, because we include and transcend. I mean, we can have an integral perspective, we can have a world-centric perspective, we can have a cosmocentric perspective. But you know what? When the rubber meets the road, we have an ethnocentric perspective. It's not to say that's the only perspective we have, but when it happens to one of our own, we notice the difference. And that's just, I'm not making any big judgment about just where we are, even as integralists in our own development.
Well, it might be interesting to hear from a couple people who are outside of the U.S., maybe, like, I know Bina's on the line or anybody else. Maybe if you'd press 1 on your handheld if you're outside of the United States, maybe we could just hear what you're experiencing and what you might want to offer.
Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, I'm in Nova Scotia. What I felt was, I think initially, just absolute shock and horror like everybody else. Where I went with it, where I went to the, you know, oh, here we go again. And I thought the last thing I wanted to do was listen to the media do its usual song and dance around it and the speculation and this and the that, and that made me kind of disgusted. And then the other side, which for me, I mean, it was kind of interesting about the point that somebody else made that the gun laws were overturned almost in the same week by the Senate. That's kind of an interesting point because I had noticed that. But the other place that I went with it was, when are we ever going to figure out as a human race how to not self-destruct? That, to me, is just one of those places where I go into my, I guess, despair. And then, so that immediately puts me back out into staying steady with the hope that we will. So I kind of do reverse process, I guess. So I go to the despair place first, and then I go out to, okay, so let's see all the good things that are going on. And so then I immediately start looking at all the things that I know are happening that are good and that are positive and that are, and then I hold my own ground with that, and I hold my own space with that, and I hold my own knowing with that, and my own, you know, just genuine desire and genuine belief that we as a human race can somehow stop this pattern of self-destruct. So I guess
let's look into that, because I like what you said, when are we? And that moves us very naturally into a conversation about we. So I'm wondering, Jeff, Terry, I'm wondering, who are the we's when you engage this event? Who are the we's that you identify with? And what are you saying we? What's the rest of that sentence that starts with we when you think about this?
Jeff here again. I'd say we're doing it, actually. In a book I would recommend to anybody who's interested in this sort of thing, a book that I would recommend, it was the book of the year for me last year. Steven Pinker, MIT, Harvard, very credible academic, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Decreased. We are doing it. If you look at the violence in tribal cultures, it's up to 20%, particularly of men, in terms of these blood feuds and these back and forths and the endless wars, and on up through the levels of development. If we think even of the American Civil War, 2% of the population of the United States engaged in that war were killed. It's shocking. If that were extrapolated to our country today, it would be 6.5 million people were killed in a war with each other. 6.5 million people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we look at Abraham Lincoln as this sort of demigod, and, you know, I remember even as a kid, you know, that we have to keep the Union together, and we had to have this war, and I think, really? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think Lincoln's great, and I love the Spielberg movie and all that good stuff.
Well,
but,
Better Angels of Our Nature isn't Better Angels of Our Nature, isn't that from Lincoln? Isn't that a quote from Lincoln?
Yeah, it is, actually. It's funny. Yeah, thank you, Di. I mean, that's mm-hmm. right. But, you know, we are living in a progressively more pacifistic and civilized as we continue to move up the stages of development. Now, to see something like this in Boston, it's just sort of this shocking. This is another thing I'd point out, is that the media, well, first of all, there's the cable media, and there's the 24-hour and round-the-clock, and everybody needs something new, and it's hyped up. And we have to remember that media in general is
about... Is the media not us? Is the media not us, guys? Let's, in terms of
it
the
is.
We, do we...
Absolutely.
Do we include the media as the we, or is it an it?
No, well, it's a we, and we...
It's an it, too.
it's an it, too, but we want to... I notice myself. Do I want to watch PBS where they have a reasoned, you know, 15-minute segment where they have, you know, reasonable people who aren't arguing about all this? Or do I want to watch Chris Matthews or Sean Hannity where they're screaming and yelling and they raise my adrenaline level? The truth is, I like my adrenaline level, you know. I mean, I like to get sort of tweaked. But you have to notice that the model of the media is about keeping your eyeballs, you know. And so they're very good at hooking our nervous system.
That's the whole point. That's
exactly
the whole point. That's why it's weird.
Yeah. They're
because
selling ads.
Yeah, they're reverse engineering our nervous system.
I'm gonna include the we in that we of the media, for the media is us, likes having a conversation. And they keep talking about it ad nauseum. They're like me. That's what I do.
Exactly. Thank you, Di.
And I like to do it in really dramatic ways.
Thank you.
And just make it a big deal and act like it's such a big deal because it's my life and it's what I care about and what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So they're just talk junkies, and so am I. And it is a different media than we might want.
From a shadow perspective, it's easy to say that media, look at what they're doing. Hey, that's us. We do the same thing. Look at our conversations with our friends. We look at those politicians. Look at those callow, shallow, greedy. It's so easy to project all of that on these politicians instead of owning it on ourselves. So, you know, this is good practice to look at this and say, okay, how is that me?
Let's go one step further. I'm going to ask a question, Terry. Count for us, okay? How many people on the line have had a moment or more since this happened where we included the bomber? The person, the part of me that is so frustrated that I get destructive, the part of me that, you know, does things that create incredible suffering for other people, and I don't even have my head around that. Like, how many of you had a moment where you found this terrorist / deranged part of yourself? Have we got anybody on the line for whom that's a we? The hardest one of all to identify with, of course.
I'd confess to that myself. You know, I remember as a 6-year-old sitting on my front porch burning the antenna off of ants with my matches. And, you know, I look back on that with a certain horror.
With you included, Jeff, that makes it 11 people out of over 90 on the call.
All right.
Wow. Include me? Because I definitely have that streak in my
head. Okay, that makes it 12.
Hey, Bev, if you're still on the line, maybe you could that the poem that you were talking about of Thich Nhat Hanh is really about that, I think. It's about picking up our identification with pretty much every role. So the role of those being hurt, the role of the runners, the role of the spectators and the enthusiasts, the role of the city of Boston in sponsoring this, the role of the emergency response people, the role of Americans, the role of anybody who's terrorized, the role of all of us who create suffering for other people. We do that.
Yeah.
And we're all vulnerable, as Jeff mentioned at the very beginning of the call. Now, that's going to help us transition into talking about the it's. You know, how do we actually address this? You know, and we can take a perspective as it's outside of us, and that's legitimate. That's what we like about Integral, is the it's are real. And then what happens when we make it a we, and we take it from a more intimate inside perspective, knowing what we know about those impulses in ourselves? I listened to the one caller talk about, actually, let's address the upper right and see what happens in people's cognition, the neocortex, who actually think it's okay to blast males into innocent bystanders. What is that? So, Terry, did you want to say something about the we?
Well, for me, the real inquiry here is how to make our we more resilient. Because the media is a reflection of what grabs our attention. And that's why, for instance, the editing of both movies and television has evolved over the last 40 or 50 years to quick cuts and dramatic action, because we have this orienting response. If you were a hunter-gatherer in the jungle and something moved suddenly, you needed your attention to go to it automatically without thought. So the way TV is edited it drags our attention into it. It's like it's eye candy. It sucks us in. And therefore, it to some degree plays to our lowest common denominator. And so the we tends to be dominated by things that stimulate threat and fear or sexual arousal or a variety of other hardwired impulses. And that doesn't raise us up. And when I see this kind of thing going on, the question that I'm wondering is, what would it be that would be so sticky? What would it be that would grab eyeballs? What would it be that would draw us in, that would uplift us instead of draw us down to our lowest common denominator? How can we come together in a way that ennobles us and that raises us up? How can our better responses to this not only be the thing we do that rises above the mass, but somehow influence the mass? And it's more of a koan, a question that I don't so much have an answer to, is that it feels important to continue to hold it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's use that as a departure point then, and go ahead and I think maybe we'll do smaller groups, Terry, groups of just two or three, just due to time. So we want to give you a minute to reflect on the we's that are important to you in this conversation, and your we's don't have to reflect our we's. You know, whatever we's are really important to you, and maybe the question is, how do we practice our resilience, or how do we outgrow hurting, you know, our violence, or how do we learn to protect ourselves, whatever the we's are that are relevant to you. So we'll give you 6 minutes, you'll get a one-minute warning, and we'll see you back in the main room when you're finished.
Let's bring whatever came out of that, or just whatever you really feel offers a unique or a valuable perspective to this conversation, forward at this time. So please raise your hand just by pressing 1 if you have something that feels worth contributing. John Reed, welcome.
Love the conversation. Although I know every we has their own confirmation bias, every tribe, every clan. And I just wonder if we have a confirmation bias as integralists for full-heartedly believing like angels of our better nature. I really love that book. I've been quoting it, telling my family about it, because I want so much to believe it. But I think, really, it's probably true but partial, in the sense that criticism of that book have been extremely well thought out about, you know, many of his peers have said, hey, he's off base, you know, and part of it's true, but there's so much that he leaves out in the institutional violence, the violence of poverty, and those other aspects. So I don't know, I'm just conflicted. I want so much to believe it, but I think it's a confirmation bias of integral.
Good comment.
That's a very interesting point. Thank you, John. Sharona, hi. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. Well, it's interesting. John kind of made the point that I was going to make, and I haven't read the book, but I've heard you, Jeff, make that argument about how much less violent we are becoming, and indeed, it's true. We're certainly becoming less bloody. We're not going around bludgeoning people quite as much in spite of horrible bombs and all that. But what I've become aware of, more and more aware of recently, is that something like 25% of women in this country are victims of sexual violence. And that is violence, you know, period. It's the violence is taking different forms. And as John was saying, you know, the violence of poverty and the degrees of social injustice, it's a more complex kind of violence, which I think comes with the upward spiral of evolution. It does take different guises, and it's still insidious, you know. But anyway, that's the we that I'm really identifying with in this conversation.
Yeah. Hmm. Thanks so much, Sharona. Dorothea, hi.
Hi. A perspective that I'd like to offer that I haven't heard yet is that I would like to be really proud of my country and know that it's respected in the world and beloved in the world. And I wonder, what is it that we have to shift in order to be what some people call the most wonderful country in the world that is beloved and respected? And I think there have been, you know, times when we've approached that, like with the Marshall Plan and foreign aid, but we've come so far from that. And I have a deep sadness about that, and I wish for that to be, for us to move in that direction and extend kindness and generosity in the world that generates respect.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a powerful we. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Monica, good pastor.
I think the perspective that I'd like to offer is one of the things that I felt in terms of listening to the news. You know, the mother was being interviewed by a newscaster, and, you know, she was talking about, you know, her daughter and the loss of her daughter. And then I was listening to a couple of other people being interviewed, and my question was, you know, it's like, how can they do this? I mean, how can they share, you know, so immediately after an experience, you know, such a traumatic experience, and how can someone interview them? And so it's this dynamic of, you know, we all feel at some level what they feel, you know, only we can't never really feel what they feel in terms of the loss or their experience. But somehow this need to be included. But I was really, it was kind of shocking to me, especially to hear, you know, I think, where did they get these people to interview them? How did they find them? Why did they agree? And maybe it's this need for voice, you know, to have shared grief, you know, this, you know, to touch us in some way that we become this we.
Thank you. Suzanne, cool, welcome.
I experienced the we of the integral, in this case, as being rushed to transcend, to take the big picture and not to be allowed to actually stay with the terror and the visceral reaction that I had. And I just wanted to point out that there is good reason to also pay full attention to that and not to immediately look for the, you know, the redeeming and the positive and what can we do when indeed as human beings we are so vulnerable and there's actually less we can do than we often imagine. At least that's my perspective, and the randomness of the universe and the randomness and the fragility of life is just something to fully embrace and not immediately go to the what's good and wonderful and how we can make it better and all that. That's sort of where I am, and I wonder whether anybody else is in the same sort of existential spot.
Well, I'm sure that many other people are. And I certainly respect that. I think there's even room for hatred and vengeance. You know, we can go even that far, because we do need to protect ourselves from violence. And I think that vulnerability is important for you to voice.
I think what you're saying is really, really important, because whether it's an I or whether it's a we, the fact is that we all have parts of our experience that are extremely painful, emotionally very taxing, and that's not something that we experience just alone. That we actually experience that with each other, and a sense of powerlessness, and a sense of fear. So I'm really happy that you're pointing that out. I'm certainly not asking people to transcend that. I'm more interested in just capturing where the identity is moving from I to we to it. And I'm really am pleased you brought that in. It's awesome. Because it's just true, Suzanne. It's just true.
Thank you.
It's scary, and it's devastating.
Yes, and can we have both? I mean, can we really feel, I mean, as integralists, as multiple perspective holders, can we hold both?
Yes, that would be my view, that you can hold both the terror and the full awareness of human death and vulnerability and mortality and all of that, and at the same time reach and hope and try to be as good as we can, but not to forget that all of that other stuff is also in us.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Suzanne, not to forget that there's an upward draft of civilization that is also online.
But that's just such a small part of the whole universe. There's so much randomness out there. It just more than the we seems to me always a bit having too much power, too much the idea that it can indeed make a difference, and it is not as much part of systems of systems of systems that we don't understand and that are seem to be random if we watch them. Even if we believe in evolution, there's still a lot of randomness in that as well.
Well, I would just say, yes, there's lots
Thank
of randomness
you.
And there's lots of pain and suffering and God, yes.
Yeah.
And it's not a small part that is lessening. That's not a small part. And that the world is actually organized and becoming more organized is not a small part.
From the big picture perspective, it's a big deal. But from the in terms of the experience of individual human beings, the randomness is really, really big. And the fact that it's gradually getting less.
Well, that's well established.
Much good if I just lost my son, you know.
I would never make this argument to somebody who's lost their son. I'm making this argument to sophisticated integralists.
But also here's another point. Maybe here's the wedge, maybe between the two poles of this, which Suzanne and Jeff are representing.
I'm holding
really
two
well.
Poles.
Yeah, you're
Go
holding
on.
Two poles, but you're holding two poles in yourself. But you're also just standing in this moment in the discourse for the pole of the momentum, and that we're moving
well,
upward.
Just want to make what sure that that's online.
Well, yeah. What I want to say is that I think where there's a lot of power is in having the free attention to choose, as Aurobindo said, not to be in relationship to the its, but actually where am I ultimately going to place my attention? So that, you know, on the one hand, it's horrifying and it's terrible, and on the other hand, there is a movement towards greater and greater identification, which means greater and greater compassion, and that in this moment, I actually can make a choice. I have enough free attention to choose, you know, to actually relieve the suffering in the world and to participate in that movement. But you can't do that effectively if you don't do what Suzanne said and what you're arguing for, Jeff and Terry, and everybody who's gotten on this second part has been representing that other piece. We have to include that. Like, that's the paradox of practice, is that you have to include the shit and the horror in order to actually, you know, become a conscious participating member of what Aurobindo called the goodness.
Yes, yes.
And Suzanne, I'm aware that you spent a lot of time in Boston and that you went to, you know, Boston is where you live.
The personal story of my daughter who was there and who is pregnant and was terrified and now doesn't dare to go out because of it, that really struck deeply, deeply.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thank you for speaking up.
Give her our love and everybody, you know, who was directly affected in the way she was and you are now.
Thank you.
Hey, Jeff, go ahead. What were you going to say? There's more. I think this
well,
is a good
I mean,
exchange.
You know, first of all, just God bless your daughter, Suzanne. You know, God bless her. Pregnant and seeing this and good Lord. I mean, how could we over feel that or over value that? We can't.
Mm-mm.
And there's another piece that we can look at that is also valuable, and it's like even to go back to John and Sharona about poverty and women's violence. I mean, is there anybody who is arguing that there's more poverty than there has been in the past? No, it's not. We're not arguing about the condition of this world compared to some ideal where there's no poverty. We're talking about the world as it is compared to how it has been, and we have more calories per person than and material wealth per person, even with the increased population, than we've ever had before. In terms of violence, Sharona, the fact that we understand that there's 20% or 25% of women who are the victims of sexual violence, that itself is a sign of the development of civilization, that we even know that, because in traditional and particularly pre-traditional or red warrior societies, women were chattel. I mean, the idea of sexual violence to women never occurred to people. It was just the way it was. And so, you know, we're not comparing the world as it is to some ideal. That's what First Tier does. We're looking at the world as an evolving system and seeing that, yes, there's tragedy. You know, I always think of the Desiderata, you know, with all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams. It's still a beautiful world, and it's an ever more good, true, and beautiful world.
the space I want to create is one that really appreciates that point of view, Jeff, but it's also one that really creates room for it to be challenged and therefore become more nuanced and in a way more heartbroken in the way in the places where the kind of experience that Suzanne's daughter had and that terror and the fact that we are subject to that kind of violent randomness is really deeply felt and not overridden by the big picture. And I think you come on so strong with that argument that it's as though there's not space in the integral living room for those other perspectives. And there is. There really is room for us all to be with all of it.
I'm saying both.
You're getting an important point, though, and I think it's just one we ought to just name for what it is. There is a view in which good and bad equally interacting, and there's a view that there is a trajectory in which more consciousness brings more identification, brings more love. So, but in those views, I don't know, Terry, I'd be interested to hear how, because it sounds like, and we're getting theoretical, we're in the it now, everybody, just so you know, we've gravitated to it, what is the nature of it, and, you know, is it good, is it bad, is it both, it, but is it in process in a way in which there's a certain, that more complex nervous system means more consciousness, mm-hmm. and therefore more capacity to know itself, and Jeff is arguing really strongly that there is. What do you think, Tara?
It's undeniable that that's true. But in the moment when people are maimed and killed, that isn't the only thing to talk about. And there are other aspects of our experience that ground us in our humanity and that don't override that experience of vulnerability. The optimism of the big picture is a necessary component of our view, but it doesn't overwhelm all the other aspects of our experience. So I don't think it's an either-or at all. It's very much a both-and, but that both-and has room for deep tears and a sense of woundedness and deep searching questions, even if it's all framed in the long-run goodness of the evolutionary process and the positive progress of humanity. You know, I can die, you can die, we can lose much of what we love in the short run. And that humbles us and grounds us in a good way. And I think that was Suzanne's point.
Yes?
I agree, 100%. And I would just say that has there been one shred of the positive in the media? I guess I just leave it at that, Terry. I mean,
I haven't watched lots and lots of media, but I have seen articles about why don't we have more of this? Isn't it amazing that we are so good?
Yeah, you're right, actually.
How many people
there is a shred.
toward the explosion instead of away from it in order to help?
Yes. No, you're right, there is a shred.
But actually, Jeff, I mean, actually, Terry, Jeff is raising your question now because it was what you said earlier, which is how does the media operate in such a way that it supports our... I think you used the word resilience and you used the word, did you use the word nobility or something? Because you were a few minutes ago saying the same thing. It's like there's something about how it gets represented that's, and maybe we need to make a nice distinction. So here's a good integral moment, everybody. So we're making a distinction between the immediacy of Suzanne's and her daughter's experience, which her daughter is terrified and really injured, and they're dealing with that in a very direct way, versus a kind of narrative which, you know, the media creates, which is, you know, tends to heighten people's fear and an over, you know, like there's a distinction to be made here between the immediacy of one's experience and then the tendency of the way the narrative is told to forget the greater context, whether it's, you know, the scale of this terrorist attack, whether it's how much more in danger you are of dying in an automobile, whatever it happens to be. So I think this is a nice integral moment, you know, to see how these perspectives can interact and how these different dimensions of who we are can all be present in this conversation right now. So I thought it was interesting that you seem to now to be, you said earlier what Jeff is saying now.
Yeah, good point. Very true. You know, what I'm drawn to right now as I'm thinking about it is I had a really beautiful email from a friend in Norway, and right after the horrible slaughter there, which was so shocking, you know, so many people were killed that virtually everybody in Norway knew somebody who had lost someone. You know, it was much more devastating, really, to that small country than this. And I was asking him how he was coping, how he was dealing with it. We were having a conversation, and at a certain point I said, how are you practicing with it? And he said his first response had been to become enraged that I would be trying to bring practice in. And then he kind of realized the choices as to how he related with his attention and his emotion and his way of sorting through his perspectives really do matter, and that there is a practice moment, especially when we're thrown into disarray, when our usual pattern is violated. It's then that it's most important for us to find our way to a deeper, wider, more profound, more present, more caring relationship to experience.
Some people would argue that the dualism of reality is precisely about that, that we actually get to decide how we're going to participate in a really profound way. And that is not to discount that, to include it, but then to create an intention. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, exactly right. The dualism is what creates the tension that makes this a place for practice. And in that, my gratitude opens up. You know, the fact that there are these horrors, if I were closer to the explosion itself, it would be harder for me to return to what is, from this distance, my sanity, which is my gratitude for life itself and for the ability to take these perspectives and for a community of good people with whom I can have these conversations. The profundity of all that is, you know, thank you. And how can I give back becomes my question. And
how can I give back?
Source of love. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I'm just going to conclude by saying I just want to recite the Bodhisattva vow as the Dalai Lama has expressed it, which is to say that for as long as space endures and for as long as living beings remain, until then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. That's
say that,
the power
say that
of that.
Again, Dai.
For as long as space endures and for as long as living beings remain who suffer, until then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world.
Oh, amen.
So thank you, everybody, for being on the call, and I loved what you said about gratitude and having a community who can have this kind of conversation. I really appreciated the exchange here at the end, and Jeff, Carrie, and I'll give it back to you to close it out.
Well, yes, thank you, dear, and thank you all, and what fun, and what opportunity to really feel, and to feel our bellies and our loins and our hearts and our throats. I mean, that is a practice in and of itself, to feel this incident and to feel all of the pain of the world and the tragedy of the world and the fact that we're all going to die. And sometimes we're going to die as children and sometimes we're going to die as old people. And to feel it actually in our bodies is a really beautiful and rich practice. And I'm feeling it right now. And I'm grateful to everybody who brought their perspectives to this conversation. I love you all. I really do. I mean, it's a great privilege to be with this group. And so thank you all. And thank you to my dear sister, Diane, my dear brother, Terry. And if I may just interject this short commercial message here. What got us going on this was that we were having our meeting about an event we're doing in Boulder at the Integral Center in October, starting October 31st and to November 3rd. So it's just basically a long weekend, a Thursday night to a Sunday midday. and I would invite you all. It's
Ken
called
will be
the
there.
Integral
Ken
Living
will be
Room.
There.
And Ken will be there, absolutely, yes, indeed. And the whole point of this is to do something that we've always sort of valued about all of the integral events that we've done. And that is, you know, we go have the integral psychotherapy event, and we have the integral leadership, and we have the integral art, and we have the spirituality, and they're all great. And we have, you know, content, and we have curricula. But what we often leave with is, gosh, what was really the most valuable was just being with each other and having conversations. It's like the breaks were better than the sessions. So what we're doing is we're going to do an event where it's all break, and or more break than session is. And it's all about having conversations.
Break.
Yeah, exactly. So it's about having, it's a living room. It's where we're going to have, the Integral Center is, it's an old church, and it's just a lovely space in Boulder in a beautiful time of year. And we're going to facilitate conversations where the goal is for people to be seen and to see each other deeply. And to have conversations like we had where we can get a little pissed and we can get a little strident and we can, you know, make our point and we can, you know, it's always, I always think of something that Keith Witt said, who's a wonderful member of the integral community, a psychotherapist for many years. And he said that there's really two things that orient his practice as a psychotherapist. And he said literally tens of thousands of sessions with clients. And that is to maintain a dialectic, number one. And a dialectic, as he describes it, is that you are willing to influence and be influenced. And gosh, that is not easy. And that is a wonderful practice. And number two is to just keep the conversation going, to not withdraw, to not hide, to not get mad, to not, you know, freeze up, but to keep the conversation going. And those two things are magic.
Give us
the Rumi quote again. Okay,
mm-hmm.
All right. Let me walk over and get it going here, because it really is beautiful. And thank you, Dai, for bringing it up. And Rumi says, and I'll close with this: there are three ways to approach the mystery of the divine. The first practice is prayer. The second is meditation. And the third, and most important, is conversation. God bless us all. Thank you so much. See you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for your time.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.